Case number 12-5331, Carolyn Jurwitz et al., Appellants v. United States Department of Agriculture et al. Mr. Kasten for the appellants, Mr. Birch for the appellees.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Ira Kass on behalf of appellants. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. There are approximately 620 forms 7003 that are in dispute in this case that are found in the administrative record. Of those, approximately 400 were submitted to USDA by individuals who were seeking to renew their licenses as breeders and dealers, dog breeders and brokers. About 200 were submitted by husband-wife teams, and only the remaining few were submitted by closely held corporations. What all this means is that in this case, we're dealing with the confidential, private, personal, financial information of more than 800 people. In contrast to the complex farm ownership structures that were involved in the multi-air case decided by this court. Now, these forms mirror the financial situation of these individuals and family members who are small business owners. And that's because the forms contain two critical business-related financial sets of information. First, it contains gross revenue dollar amounts, in many instances taken directly from tax returns of these individuals. And secondly, it contains sales volume data reflecting the number of dogs that these people in their small businesses have sold in the prior year. Now, the USDA, in its February 2012 decision, which ordered disclosure of all this confidential information in all these forms, that decision, we contend, was arbitrary and capricious, an abuse of discretion, and not in accordance with law, because the arbitrariness or the reasonableness of the decision has to stand or fall on what the agency itself wrote, not on post hoc rationalizations of counsel or of the district court below. And we'll stand on our briefs with regard to the purported public interest in disclosure in this case, but briefly, If your honors look at the record, you'll find that the agency did not explain, let alone satisfactorily explain, how disclosure of this information would let the public know what the government is up to, or would significantly shed light on the agency's activities. The statements that by the agency in the decision regarding the public interest are bold. They are conclusory, and they're unsupported by the record. And so if the court agrees with us on this contention, then the case is over, because you don't have to go to the balancing that Exemption 6 would otherwise require, balancing the public interest versus the privacy.
Would you repeat what you just said, the last sentence or so?
I'm sorry. Okay. I apologize.
I understand.
Okay. If the court agrees with us that there is no public interest in disclosure, then the case is over, because then you don't have to go into balancing the public interest versus the privacy interests. And the court can remand this case directly to the district court for entry of summary judgment on our behalf.
Thank you, Ken.
All right. So government responded in its brief pointing out that your evocation of a public interest factor is inconsistent with what we've said in our cases. you focus about sheds, significant light, et cetera.
Right.
But we've simply said, you know, the public would have greater difficulty verifying something, or this information can enable the public more easily to a much lower standard than your substantial light-shedding standard. What's your response on that?
Well, I have two responses. First of all, with regard to the standard itself, the Supreme Court in FLRA is the one that set the standard of significance here.
So all these cases are off the, all of our precedent is to be ignored.
I say that Consumers Checkbook does talk about significance as well. But I would suggest the paradigm as follows to the court, if I may.
Well, I want to be clear about this. Are you saying all of this precedent is contrary to the Supreme Court's FLRA case?
I'm saying that even if, in this particular instance, some light would be shed for the public to understand what the government is up to, that would be insufficient to be able to even get to the balancing part of Exemption 6, because all that it does is take private information and then it just is, there's only little or nothing that is being revealed to the public over here that will help them understand what the government is up to. That's what I'm saying. I would also say that what's really important, and certainly not against precedent in this court, mm-hmm. is that the agency did not explain itself. The statements are conclusory in nature. And that by itself makes that part of the decision arbitrary, capricious, and reversible. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to turn my attention just for a moment to the privacy interest in the event that this court...
So let me ask you, the agency on page 7 of its final decision spells out what it views.
Well, let's examine that, Judge Rogers.
It's talking about members of the public.
Right, exactly. This is what it says. Members of the public can use the gross dollar amount from mm-hmm. regulated activities to analyze whether the agency is properly assessing fees in accordance with its regulations. Mm-hmm. Doesn't say how.
Well, the fees, there's segmented fees.
Yes.
So if I'm paying a certain amount, or if I have a large operation, I can trace back. I mean, I don't think that's very difficult, is it?
You could trace back to what? I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, if I'm, you're saying, it says here that, one, if I know what the gross revenue is, and I know the number of dogs.
Right.
Then I can figure out what the fee ought to be.
Well, first of all, you don't need to know the number of dogs to be able to figure that out. All you need is gross revenue and compare that number to a schedule in the regulations.
So why is that easy?
But first of all, that goes to collection of fees, not assessment of fees. What the agency said about collection is continued on that page.
Right.
And again, all that it says is as follows. In addition, members of the public can determine whether the agency is fulfilling the mandate of Congress to, quote, and all it does now is mimic the statute, charge, assess, and cause to be collected reasonable fees, which shall be adjusted on an equitable basis, taking into consideration the type and nature of the operations
so
to be licensed. There's no explanation.
As I understand our precedent, the information doesn't have to shed light on all of those things. It could shed light on some of them, or one of them.
That may be so, but it's not shedding.
Agency charging.
But the agency is not explaining itself at all. It's just a conclusory statement here. Doesn't say how.
But I mean, if it's just self-evident.
We have a lot of cases that say if we can infer the course of the agency's reasoning, that's sufficient, even when they only make a statement. So if it's self-evident, that would fall within that, wouldn't it?
Well, I would suggest as follows. I would say that in this case in particular, the agency on three separate occasions have ruled that Exemption 4 or 6 applies.
That just means the agency has changed its mind.
Well, but then what the precedent in this court says is there's got to be a reasoned analysis explaining mm-hmm. why the agency changed its mind. Mm-hmm. There's no reasoned analysis over here at all.
Well, it talks about discrepancies. So you say that this whole paragraph on page 7 is just not reasoned?
I think it's conclusory. I think it's self-evident in that regard.
So it should have said, sort of where we were in the first case, it should have said you can take this dollar amount and go look at what fee ought to be charged. That sentence would have done it?
Well, it might have done it. But then, even if it did so, I think it's just a minimal public interest over here. Anybody could do that. There's no allegation in the record that the agency can't compare two numbers. There are no allegations in the record of fraud.
No, the question is, can the public?
I'm sorry?
The question is, with this information being released, can the public? That's what this paragraph is all about.
Well, that's true, but in most instances, and I agree at this stage we're at a reverse FOIA situation, but in most instances, this type of information, the requester of the information would have to have made some sort of case regarding fraud or deceit.
No, our cases don't require that.
And not in reverse FOIA, that's correct.
Yeah.
I agree. That's what I said, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I agree with that. Okay, but this case really started out not as a reverse FOIA case.
Yeah, but that's not where we are now.
Okay, I understand.
I mean, you know, the agency changed his mind.
I certainly accept that.
So you have to deal with that.
So yes, even if we were to agree with you that this case is like one of our previous cases where we said we affirm the agency, even if it were a direct FOIA rather than reverse FOIA, we would agree with you. That's a different standard than if it's a direct FOIA. And we have to defer more to the agency's view of what is in the public interest than we would in that kind of case.
But that doesn't mean that the agency can't or doesn't have to explain itself. Mm-hmm. It has to explain itself. And here it did not do that. And it didn't offer us any opportunity to address these issues when the case was before the agency.
Well, that's yet another question. There's no notice and comment requirement with respect to FOIA in the APA, and they did provide some opportunity for you to respond to this.
Yeah, but I would suggest, Judge Garland, that under 7 CFR 1.112, which is their FOIA regulation, there are different stages involved. And one of the stages is that they're supposed to provide the submitter an opportunity to object to any decision. That means after they made their decision, they have to give us the opportunity now to object. They didn't do that. And only later in that same regulation, it says that afterwards, provide business information submitters with notice of any determination to disclose such records prior to disclosure date for possible judicial intervention. So there's another stage here.
They did do that, right? These documents haven't been disclosed yet, have they?
I'm sorry?
Have the documents already been disclosed?
The documents have not been disclosed. So they gave us opportunity,
yes,
with respect to judicial intervention. I agree with that. They didn't give us opportunity before the agency itself, which is what the first part of the regulation.
Could you reconsider? Based on the opinion?
I'm sorry?
I'll let Judge Rogers.
Could you have moved to reconsider?
Well, actually, we did once, Judge Rogers, and the agency agreed with us that their first decision in this case.
No, but I mean on the final decision.
Well, there's nothing in the regulations that talk about reconsideration. And by that point already, HSUS was in court. And it's only after the agency had already said that the case should be dismissed with prejudice that they changed their mind, and so we had to file our reverse FOIA case. And indeed, the final decision of February 2012 said that we'd have to file in court by X date or else the information would be disclosed.
Tell me which part of 1.2 you're referring to. I'm sorry.
Okay, so in the very first paragraph,
yes,
Judge Garland.
Yes.
Okay. So
which
the sentence beginning when?
Yes.
When in the course of responding to a FOIA request,
yes,
an agency cannot readily determine,
yes,
whether the information obtained from a person is privileged or confidential business information.
And that would be exemption 4. That would be exemption 4, right?
Right.
That specifically would be exemption 4.
Right. So what about, leave that to the side. I understand that point. What about exemption 6?
Well, there's nothing in here. It says later on, let me just continue reading.
Mm-hmm.
It says, whether the information obtained is privileged or confidential information, the policy of USDA is to obtain and consider the views of the submitter of the information and to provide the submitter an opportunity to object to any decision to disclose the information, any decision that would include exemption six.
That doesn't strike me as the right reading. This says when in the course the agency can't determine whether it's privilege.
Stage one.
The policy is to obtain and consider the views and to provide the opportunity and opportunity of the submitter an opportunity to object to any decision. But it's the when. It's an if-then situation, it seems like, here. I'm actually surprised that it only applies to Exemption 4, but it seems clearly to only apply when they're having an Exemption 4 problem.
Well, the fact of the matter is that in this case, when they reopened the record, we certainly made arguments under Exemption 6. So I would argue that implicit in here, they were in agreement with us that we had that opportunity. In fact, the final decision certainly dealt with Exemption 6. It was not only restricted to Exemption 4.
That's different than whether the agency has violated its regulations or the APA with respect to comment.
Well, respectfully, again, this is a reading that we would give give it over here. And, sure. And it's not unprecedented. We cited a Fourth Circuit case in which there was an opportunity by an agency to, in a reverse FOIA kind of case, where they came to a preliminary determination and they invited people in to make comments. And then later on, after they received those comments, they made their final decision and then it went on to court.
Well, this circuit used to make all kinds of requirements like that because it seemed like good policy, and the Supreme Court knocked us down pretty firmly in Vermont Yankee, saying we don't have any authority to do that unless the statute requires it. Or perhaps unless the regulations require it.
Well, I would submit that the regulations here do offer that opportunity for this court to read it in such fashion to make that requirement. If I may just turn to the privacy interests briefly.
Do you really need to? If the government really contesting your privacy interests?
Well, in the balance part, if the court doesn't want to hear that and wants to rest its decision that there was no public interest in disclosure whatsoever, as I said before, we win, and that case is over.
But well, we still have the balance, and you would agree on that also. We have to defer in a different way on a reverse FOIA case than in a direct FOIA case, right? At least I'm right about the standard, right?
Well, you don't have to defer with respect to the FOIA standards themselves and the application of FOIA itself.
But whether something is clearly unwarranted, those words, we right. have to defer. Obviously, it could be arbitrary and capricious, but that's the standard, which is a different standard than we would apply in the direct case.
But again, there's nothing...
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
But there is nothing in the decision that really explains how they did the balance properly or otherwise. And what USDA in its briefs and HSUS in their briefs is really doing is they're relying heavily on this court's decision in Multiav to support the case, the decision below. And we would submit that multi-ag is distinguishable for a number of different reasons. First of all, in multi-ag, you are not dealing with this type of financial income-related information. You are dealing with only crop information. You're dealing with maps and photos of farmland. Income-related, revenue-related information is held to a higher standard. And we would submit that the consumer's checkbook case is more analogous because in that case, you are dealing with the income of doctors from the Medicare program. And even there, even though there was no net income that would be revealed by disclosure of this information, the court found that privacy interest prevailed. And here, it's even greater.
That was not a reverse FOIA case.
It was not.
So we didn't have this troubling problem of what we do about balancing in a reverse FOIA case.
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that the court can and should do a proper balance in accordance with the law. If the agency was not applying the principles, which should be the same, whether it's from multi-ag or from consumers, to this case, then it's arbitrary and capricious.
Let me just ask about that one point, not about the privacy, but the other. If we evaluated the public interest, assume there was low private, assume... for the purpose of this hypothetical, that there was enough privacy in the consumer's case to sort of get us to the requirement of a balancing, but very little. Assume that just for the moment. I know that's not correct, but assume that. Assume that in that case, we said the public interest was not sufficient, which we did, to permit
to get to
disclosure, the benefit. Right. And if the agency says, in our view, now we have the exact same case, exactly the same, but it's now a reverse FOIA case, and they've decided to disclose it. We would, just because they evaluate the public interest different than we evaluated it in that case, wouldn't bar us from having to defer to them, would it?
No, it would not. But I think the emphasis is not on the public interest. The emphasis isn't on the privacy interests that were involved over there, because at the end of Consumer's Checkbook, this court did say that even if it was a public interest, still the privacy interest would prevail. And I think that's what...
I'm not sure, though, why the privacy interest here is appreciably greater than the case in Multi-A. From the farmer's viewpoint of Multi-A, the information is disclosing data from which sophisticated observers could derive a great deal of information about the farmer's income, something similar to what the dog breeder's information would be disclosed here.
Well, I would respond, Judge Sintel, as follows. What the court in Multi-A said is that USDA could not demonstrate how often comparisons could be made from this information to explain what the financial situation of the farmers were. It said only in a few cases could that be shown. And the reason for that was because you were dealing with complex farm ownership, which is how I began this oral argument in distinguishing our case from that case. Here you're dealing with individuals, and you're dealing with information that's directly on their form.
The dissent said in Mollier, the farm ownership did disclose information about individuals. I mean, many of those farms were family-owned farms, too. I grant you many of them were not family-owned farms, but not all of these dog breeders were family-owned either.
Well, no, that's exactly the point.
There were subchapter S type ownership in the farm.
Yeah, well, Judge Sintel, that's what
I don't see the distinction on the privacy side between this and all today.
Well, if
you get your side, you may have a good distinction, but not. I'm not sure I see it on the privacy.
On the privacy interest here, there's a direct exposure of the financial information. The names are on the forms, and no inferences that have to be drawn. That's what the Multi-Year case talked about, inferences. Here, it's direct exposure of these people's financial information, including gross revenues, and which is related to tax information. So we think that that is a major distinction. Another distinction is that in Multi-Year, the court was concerned about the special need for public scrutiny because we're dealing with...
So now you're over on the public interest.
Yes.
And I see your distinction there.
Well, but that was part of the balance, Judge Sintel. So, and the truth of the matter is, even in consumers, so Judge Rogers in her dissent recognized that the doctors involved had a qualified, a quasi-public function. And there's no quasi-public function here at all whatsoever with respect to the breeders. So again, we believe that Consumer's Checkbook is a better case. It's more analogous than Multi-Ag. If the court is interested, I'll say a few words about Exemption 4.
I think we're sort of out of time, unless the court has questions. No.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hear from the Agriculture Department.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Alan Birch for the United States on behalf of the Department of Agriculture. I'd like to start with the public interest side.
If you would, can you give
yes.
a couple of succinct sentences as to what it was the board was telling us was in the public interest?
Sure, Your Honor. That's where I plan to start. There were three public interests that the agency identified. The first was helping the public be able to gauge more effectively the efficacy of the agency's enforcement arm and its inspections. The second was to determine whether the agency was actually collecting the correct fee under its fee schedule and its regulation. And the third was whether the agency's fee schedule made sense under the statutory mandate. And I'd like to start with the last of those three because that's the third one I find the agency's explanation is admittedly the most terse. And it says essentially that this information, meaning the blockade information, the gross revenue and the number of dogs, that information could help the public assess whether we, the agency, have promulgated a reasonable regulation under the statutory mandate. And the three areas to look at, which are replete in the record and in the decision document itself, are certainly the statutory mandate, the structure of this fee schedule, and what is the blockade information. Statutory mandate says that the agency is to set fees that are reasonable and equitable and to take into account the type and nature of the operations. Okay? The agency takes that and says, all right, we're going to issue this fee schedule, and we're going to break it into different classes of license, so that takes care of the type of operations, arguably. And then the schedule is going to be based on the gross revenue, and it sets categories, six categories, the top of which is $100,000 or more. So that is what the information is going to be used to judge. Did the agency come up with a reasonable schedule? So the last bit is, do these pieces of information help the public make that assessment? And I think it follows fairly naturally, fairly easily. Certainly the agency's path is reasonably discernible, that the amount of amount of gross revenue on any given licensee would help the fill in the data points about how many fall in the various parts of the schedule.
So just so I'm clear, you know that somebody has gross revenue of $300,000
right.
in 2012. Then you go to the fee schedule, and you see they should be paying a fee of, I have no idea.
I think it's around $700, Your Honor.
$700, all right.
$760 if they're not a first-timer. If it's a first-time, they get $10 discount.
Right, and you wouldn't have that information any other way.
You would have the you have some of the information, but not all of it. You would not have the $300,000. The forms, as they've been released in the past, do indicate the fee amount that the licensee pays. So you could tell already which category they
fall
in.
That's what I was going to get at. If it shows that I'm paying a $760 fee,
right, then you're in the top category.
If you look at the schedule, you would know my gross revenues.
Right. But if, for example, the data from multiple forms would inform the public as to whether the schedule should top out at $100,000, and perhaps it should have a broader range and top out at $250,000, for example, or perhaps even bigger categories. Also, it would help the agent help the public assess whether it makes sense to base the fee on revenue alone. Perhaps the fee should have been based on number of dogs.
How would this information help the public with that particular question?
Because it would
this
say...
This is the kind of thing prompted me to ask you the question.
Sorry?
This
oh,
is
I
the
see,
kind
yeah.
of thing prompted me to ask this.
Well, I think it's readily discernible from the thing that the way this would help is you would say, well, you could map out how the data falls down, and if there are large number of dogs if the number of dogs varies considered relative to the number of revenue, perhaps the number of dogs would be a more reasonable and equitable way to separate the licensees by how much they pay. It would give a basis to have this discussion in the first place. If all you have is just the fee schedule and the statute and you don't have these data points, it's difficult for the discussion to get off the ground and have an intelligible discussion. That's what this is all about in terms of enabling the public to have this kind of a discussion. That's why the public interest is clear.
It sounds like a policy decision as to whether you should base this on dogs or money.
That's one of the issues.
That would be a matter of opinion that would not vary according to what dog breeder A has in Missouri or dog breeder B has in some other part of Missouri. I'm not sure how that would.
The discussion.
You don't
would
have
be,
to win on all of these points.
No, I agree, Your Honor. I agree, Your Honor, but if I could just finish the point before I move on to the other public interest, the discussion, for example, could easily say that that the fees should be more, that if you were to correlate the number of dogs with the fees paid, that you would see that the plot is totally irregular and random and doesn't make much sense. And without that data, you couldn't have that discussion. But with the data, you could go back to the agency and say, maybe we should redo this differently. Then, you know, for example, they could meet the fee requirement by just adding, you know, whatever 1% to the price of each dog, and it would be fairly simple, pass through to the consumer. That might make a whole lot more sense. You can't even have that discussion at all without this data.
I believe you.
Okay.
So, I'm sure you agree.
Well, what's the strongest public interest?
Well, I believe that the other two are even stronger in that they're more explained. The efficacy of the agency enforcement and the inspections.
That's the one I had trouble figuring out what the agency was honestly talking about.
I see. Well, the number of, this one relates to the number of dogs.
I want to see the explanation of it.
I'll try my best. This relates to the number of dogs, not the revenue amount.
How does this deal with the enforcement?
It could raise red flags if the number reported in the application varied wildly from the numbers found on the annual inspection reports. It's that simple. If there's a gross discrepancy, it could raise a red flag in terms of either what's going on during the inspections or that there's gamesmanship going on in the application. The third is the collection of the correct fee amount under the schedule. And here it's very similar kind of analysis here. If there's a significant discrepancy, then perhaps either they've been snickered in the application by putting down the wrong amount or that there was some shenanigans going on in the inspection report, perhaps. So those, I think, are fairly well explained. To my mind, these public interests are at least comparable to the public interest in multi-ad media, and they're more than sufficient to uphold the agency's finding on a reverse FOIA APA review.
What would you describe as having been the public interest to tip the scale in multi-ag?
In multi-ag?
It's the
multi-ag, the public interest, as I understood it, was the compliance with agency's compliance with its statutory mission. Which was to make sure that the multiple subsidy programs were being administered effectively and correctly under the law, that the right people were getting the subsidies and people who weren't eligible were not getting subsidies.
And are you saying that there's something superior to that here on the subsidy?
Not superior, I would say comparable. One of the frustrations of this area of the law is that there's no scale for, putting a number of pounds on the weight, and it's very difficult to compare case to case. But I would say that you only need to find that it is roughly comparable to finish the analysis and come to a conclusion. I can address the privacy if there are questions on that.
I don't know if you add to Judge Rush.
No, thank you.
Honestly, don't see how there's any problem with the privacy stand in light of money.
I have difficulty with it myself, Your Honor. I mean, there is nothing special about financial information. The case law does not say that. You look at cases like multi-ag, which have a far deeper insight into a particular farmer's wealth, because the land, particularly the plethora of details about the land and how much it is going to be productive land, that's what makes farmland valuable. You want to know whether how many acres, you want to know how many of them are under snowpack, you want to know how many of them are under irrigation, you want to know how wide the rows are.
All of them. Prompted my decision.
I thought you were pretty much reading as you said that.
Yeah. Well, I feel your pain.
We're all aware of what the dissent does to tell you what the law is.
Well, I feel your pain having lost that case, Your Honor. So. to my mind, it's an easy balance, and certainly it's far from one where the record compels the contrary conclusion, which is what you would need to find on an APA review.
Further questions?
If there are no further questions, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Any time left? Probably not. Can you take two more minutes? Do it in 2 minutes?
Just a few points, Your Honor. First of all, if you got to the enforcement issue, our contention is that the decision is unsupported by the record with regard to enforcement and how there's a public interest in monitoring enforcement over here. And that is because the Goldentire memo on which the decision was relying deals only with comparisons that experienced inspectors can make, not the public. But we would submit even further that even inspectors can't make any of these comparisons between inventory on a one-day inspection, a snapshot picture of how many dogs are at a premise on one day versus the number of dogs that are reported that are sold over the entire year.
Just to pause over this experience, and I understand you have an additional point, but on the experienced inspector, there's no rule in FOIA that we have to take the least experienced American, what can that person get out of data? There's nothing like that. In most of the FOIA cases, we're looking at questions about what experts but outside the government might be able to understand in the public interest. There's no rule one way or the other about that, is there?
Well, we would contend that nobody can really make these comparisons.
I got that point. But okay. The difference between whether it's an expert inspector or you can get some former inspector who's now in a private citizen shouldn't make any difference here. So you really do have to show that no one could do this.
Well, I think it might make a difference in this instance because you have to be on the premises to see whether or not.
That's a different point. I understand that point.
Okay. With regard to compliance, and here's another distinction between this case and Multiag in terms of the public interest. Over there, the comparisons were apples to apples. It was the amount of crop information or data that was submitted by the farmers to the government. And then through FOIA, you could obtain the same exact information that the government determined by itself. So there was a one-to-one relationship. Here, they don't have that situation whatsoever. The number of dogs on one day are not the same as the number of dogs that are sold. You know, a business can go bust, could be doing better. There's no real comparisons that can be made. Just very, very briefly also. With regard to the public interest in determining collections and the like. There are numerous cases where the public fisc is involved, and still the privacy interest at the end prevailed. Horner is one. I think the argument was made in that situation that and the court rejected this argument that we have to know where the money is going, and that wasn't sufficient to overcome the privacy interest that was involved in the Horner case.
There's a much higher privacy interest in that case.
Well, this is a pretty high standard as well, as Judge Sentell pointed out in his dissent in Multiag. But not only that, but in consumers.
As he said, that doesn't get you there.
Yeah, but in consumers, the court agreed with Judge Sentell.
Well, it's definitely enough. That's not the question. The question is, in Horner, there's a series of three cases on this subject. Those were much higher direct personal risk to direct personal privacy than there is here.
Well, in this instance, the agency did not even take into consideration the derivative uses. That's our argument. It's one of our arguments, and there's another reason why it's arbitrary and capricious. And derivative uses, as you yourself know from ACLU versus DOJ, is something that has to be taken into consideration. And it wasn't here at all. That's part of our argument. When the government collects information, you know, you could find something that will illuminate, you know, the public as to what the government is up to. But that's not sufficient. When you're dealing with private information over here, and all you have at the end is little or nothing that will be disclosed in terms of the public interest, then you don't even get to the balancing. So we submit that this case can be decided because there was no public interest that's discernible from the agency's decision. The case is over. It should be remanded for entry of summary judgment on our behalf.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under submission.
Thank you very much.
The arguments.